Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Radio Nerd. Today, I am doing a little bit of something different. Originally, I was saying previously that this would be the final in a three-part series on gaming, and that it would be about Gamergate. I was doing some research for Gamergate earlier today, and I had forgotten how much there was there. And I think it's probably, to do it justice, I would need to listen to a lot of different videos, do a lot more reading, and do a lot more research. So I'm delaying that episode until next week, and I'm going to do my research during the week, this week, and record that episode. So instead, this episode's going to fill in the blank space here today instead of the Gamergate episode. I apologize if people were looking forward to the Gamergate one. I just don't think that I could really do it justice with the time that I have to record this specific episode. Whatever. So instead, we're going to go with a different episode name, a different episode topic to sort of doing it. It's slightly tangentially related to gaming, but it's more of a general nerd culture sort of idea and related to the topics that I've talked about in other sort of other episodes here. You can find Radio Nerd, if you have anything to say or ideas for topics that you would like to come on and talk about, comments about, previous episodes that I've had, counterpoints perhaps, whatever. You just want to talk, reach out, say hello. You can find me and the show either at RadioNerdWLU@gmail.com or on Instagram at Radio_NerdWLU. Both are places that you can, come in, send a message, ask about stuff, DM me, email me, whatever. It's all up to you. However you want to contact, whatever feels comfortable for you. Otherwise, let's get into it. So the topic of today's episode is also kind of the title. As you can see, the title is The Planet of Hats, which is a pretty well-known trope within sci-fi fantasy. I actually have the TV Tropes page up here in my other window or my other screen, and I will be talking about that in a little bit later here. Because it's an actual trope. And we're going to be talking about sort of like the problem surrounding it and everything like that. But we're first going to be sort of diving into two different sort of media and some of the examples of cultural representation and in some ways racial representation that you see in these sort of things. So we're going to start with Dungeons & Dragons, and that's how we're tangentially related to gaming. And then the other thing we're going to talk about is Star Trek. I will forewarn you, I have limited experience with Star Trek, so this is all sort of coming secondhand from close friends who are big Star Trek nerds and who have talked about sort of the different things that are in Star Trek. And I've done my fair amount of wiki reading for Star Trek, but I haven't actually watched a lot of the episodes myself, as comparable to some Star Trek nerds. So if you have points that maybe counter my discussion about Star Trek, that's fully something that you can communicate, talk to me. It's a conversation. I keep saying that, and it should honestly just be the tagline for this podcast, is it's a conversation. But it is, and it's important to have that, go-between where we're discussing things. But anyways, let's get into D&D. So Dungeons & Dragons has an unfortunately long history with bad cultural representation. And for me, not in the actual game itself, but for me, the biggest callback is from second edition of the game. A book called Oriental Adventures from Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Now, just going down, I'm going to talk about some of the things that are in this, right? So, we have... provides rules for new character classes as well as different races that can be used in standard Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. It changes some things up with regards to the Barbarian class, adding in the Steppe Warrior and Forest and Jungle Dwellers as sort of like subclasses there. It brings in the Monk. I'm not sure if the Monk was... I think the Monks were previously in Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, but they really, you know, they gained on a very Asian definition in Oriental Adventures. It also gave you new classes such as the Ninja, Kensei, Wujen, and Shukukenja. Or Shukenja? Anyways. If you're not already seeing the problems that I'm going to talk about with Oriental Adventures, I would be surprised. It was the first official supplement for Dungeons & Dragons that was devoted entirely to role-playing in a non-Western setting. Now, Dungeons & Dragons is a game that's very much so based around a specifically Western view of fantasy. A very Western and medievalist sort of idea of fantasy. Because that was who invented it, right? It was like a bunch of white guys. And, you know, that's how they saw their fantasy, and that's how their fantasy was kind of pictured for them. Now, fantasy can take many different forms in many different places around the world. And Dungeons & Dragons has more recently, and by more recently I mean the latest edition and more like within the last 5 years, has started to embrace the idea of other settings and being able to do it. I mean, people have been doing those kinds of things by themselves, but, you know, having actual resources that encourage you to do it is better, and encourage you to do it in a way that isn't actively racist, like using the word Oriental in the title. Like, Oriental, you know, it can be seen as a racially charged generalization. It's also, you know, Orientalism, which is a sort of theory brought out by Edward Said. Something that I've studied somewhat within my major. And, you know, Oriental Adventures is very much a product of Orientalism. It's, you know, a depiction of an area of the world with basically one-to-one, you know, takes that was written by someone who is clearly an outsider to that culture and understands the culture and the cultures, I should say, because Oriental Adventures kind of like takes East Asian cultures and combines them all into one in many ways and puts it all together and talks about how, you know, this should be done or viewed. You know, it's bad. There was a third edition version of it that came out in 2001. So saying this is a problem that is continuing is accurate. The original one, like I said, came out in 1985, and it was just continued. There are things that have continued and that have become part of sort of mainstream D&D from Oriental Adventures, but, you know, they've been adapted and changed in such ways that they've become more like setting neutral in many ways. That's not to say that it's better, but it's, you know, it's problematic to have a bunch of white people white men, write a book so that you can play in a specifically non-Western place when they have limited views on the area or on the place, informed by biased histories and by Orientalist visions of what it's like. Going back to this, you know, there's a long history in fantasy of, you know, the fantasy Asia or fantasy Africa or fantasy Middle East. You know, you see more of this in Dungeons and Dragons. There's a, you know, the area that Oriental Adventures takes place in is called Karatur. It's a section of the main sort of world that the Forgotten Realms setting takes place in with Dungeons and Dragons, which has been sort of the standard Dungeons and Dragons setting since third edition, basically, and up until the recent parts. And just looking through Karatur, right? It's basically just a fantasy analog of East Asia. You know, you have an analog to Imperial China, an analog to historical China, an analog to feudal Japan, an analog to Sengoku Japan, an analog to, you know, Tibet, Korea, Indonesia, Philippines, Mongolia, you know, just pre-colonial Indochina, which isn't a great pre-colonial Southeast Asia. It's better use of it. I was just reading off of the page here. I will say that, yeah, Indochina is not exactly a, that's not a modern term for the area, and it's not a term I really want to use anymore. let's stop using it. Anyways, it's, you know, really problematic that there's an entire section which is just related to this idea of like a fantasy Asia that is just one-to-one parallels to cultures that existed in pre-modern East Asia. Additionally, we have things within the same world like Zakara, which is a fictional area that is featured in the book called Arabian Nights. Oh, sorry, it's based on Arabian Nights. It's called Al-Qadim is the setting, the series of books that the setting is described in. Al-Qadim describes a fantasy Middle East. Based on Arabian Nights, and therefore based on, you know, tangentially based on the Middle East during the Middle Ages. And in my opinion, because I've read some of the Al-Qadim books, not super accurate. Anyone who's a student of history might know this. That the Middle East and the Muslim world in general during the Middle Ages was going through a golden age and was fairly peaceful, all things considered. I mean, as peaceful as any place can be. And was pretty enlightened with regards to math, science, a lot of philosophy, a lot of the like traditional or classical examples, things like Greece, Greek and Roman sort of advancements were kept alive in the post-Rome Muslim world and advanced in many ways. You know, we get modern mathematics very clearly from the Muslim world then. And, you know, you get this idea, they change things up. They definitely take another, again, Orientalist view of a different area of the world and then apply that area of the world to, you know, just full stop that world, you know, sticking it into their fantasy world. No changes or nothing. And then you also have something like Mazdika, which is another area of the greater world of Forgotten Realms. Is called Faerun. This is all like a bunch of D&D gibberish at this point. But Mazdika is fantasy. What's the area? Central America, pre-colonial Central America. So it's I'm forgetting the term for those civilizations, but it's essentially like the Aztecs, the Mexica, the Inca. You know, it's sort of an amalgamation of pre-Columbian, I guess, to use the name of a war criminal. You know, a pre-colonial sort of civilizations of Central and South America, sort of mixed up together and given sort of fantasy gleam to them. And this is not new. This is not something that is exclusive to Dungeons & Dragons, and it's not something that, you know, there aren't like a lot of problems with. More recent examples include, I think it's called Chult. Yeah, it's a section of the world that has had a more recent adventure, one that came out within the past 5 years. Or actually, you know what? It was probably before that, but within the past 10 years. And in 5th edition of Dungeons & Dragons. And it's basically like a fantasy subtropical Africa, right? And it takes a lot of those ideas. And like I said, this is all like very skewed views of areas, vast areas of the world, just sort of wholesale taken and placed into a fantasy world without any sort of ideas about why their cultures are so one-to-one equal to, you know, Earth cultures, or why, you know, people are like this and whatever. You know, it doesn't change anything. And this goes further than just, you know, groupings of nations, groupings of territory in the worlds that they create, but it goes into, you know, races. Or, you know, I talked last week about ancestries within Pathfinder and the change from race to ancestry, and how that, you know, change is really good. And it comes in especially clearly when certain races are comparable to real world cultures or real world ethnicities. I'm going to talk briefly about this because I am white, and I don't really feel that I have, what's the words that I'm looking for here? I don't have the experience to be able to fully articulate what it's like for these, for depictions like this to be within someone's media. And, you know, like, everybody could have a different idea of it. Some people maybe don't see depictions like this within fantasy, and that's perfectly fair. And some people do. I would much rather stay away from depictions of, you know, fantasy non-human races as human races, because it sort of it strays into that idea of like scientific racism, and it strays into this idea of like there being differences between like it strays into that idea of trying to justify race as not a social construct, which is something that I don't like. But dwarves and orcs are two sort of big standouts that we can talk about, and this is in fantasy and in general. And, you know, you see orcs being compared to sort of tribal or barbarian type cultures, and the idea that that makes them less advanced or that makes them evil. And it's this very deeply ingrained thing in our culture, and it comes from racism. It comes from these ideas that cultures are beneath other cultures because they live differently than them. And it's really problematic to then apply that to an entire section of a game. A game that people can be playing as those people and then be forced to interact with active racism within their leisure time, which is something that I don't think people who have to interact with active racism in their everyday lives need to do. That shouldn't be something that they have to deal with. If they're doing in their, you know, they have to deal with enough of that everyday life, they don't need to deal with that in their leisure. At least that's my opinion on it. I would hope that you would share a similar opinion, that people deserve a break from being discriminated against. They don't deserve to be discriminated against in the beginning, but I'm not going to keep going. This is a hole that I'm digging right now. But you kind of, I hope you understand what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to get across. Dwarves further as well can be seen as caricatures and depictions of specific religious minorities, like Jewish people, in many ways, with regards to specific racist ideas about that surround Jewish people. There's comparisons there, and I've seen comparisons like that online. I've seen comparisons to other people too, other peoples within dwarves. I chose dwarves and orcs because dwarves and orcs are like fairly well known with regards to fantasy archetypes, but these are by no way the only fantasy race that you'll see that is basically very comparable to human ideas of race, human ideas of culture as well. And you know, there's a lot that's been uncoupled from those people, that's been uncoupled from the fantasy, and that has been improved upon, especially more recently. But it's still a problem that's there, and there's still that problem that's ingrained within, like, you know, nerd culture and this idea of us, you know, characterizing, basically. I'm going to get back into characterizing and caricatures in general, and I'm going to talk about that more at the end of the episode here as well. Finally, I'm going to talk about one of the core classes of D&D, one of the continuing to be core classes. And I touched upon this with orcs, and I touched upon this when we talked about Oriental Adventures, but it's the barbarian class. And the fact that in earlier editions of D&D, the barbarian couldn't read. In earlier editions of D&D, Barbarian had a lot of ideas surrounding it that were very problematic. So, in history, you know, a lot of people in the West think about cultures as civilized or uncivilized, you know. Barbarian as a term has been used in many different occasions as a justification for military action against another culture or people. It has been used as justification for genocide. It's been used as justification for, or, you know, horrible acts of violence and assimilation towards other people. And it's a very outdated view of how civilizations adapt. You know, there are nomadic civilizations that did far better than other, you know, civil or other stagnant? No. Other agrarian societies. There we go. You know, societies that lived in towns and built farms. Something we're very familiar with nowadays, but that wasn't always the case. And just because, you know, a civilization in the past did things differently than how we conceptualize things now does not mean that they were backwards or wrong. You know, it's a very modern, biased look at history. And history is so much more complex than that. The little that we know about history and that we can conceptualize about history, you know, is such a small little, you know, microscopic look into those sort of worlds and those ideas. And the fact that we then apply those things to our concepts today, especially through the lens of using it to justify racism or discrimination, you know, it becomes very problematic to be playing a class like the Barbarian in some ways. Especially, you know, they have like a raging ability, which comes from ideas of Vikings to a certain degree, or you know, and then adding on to that the idea that they don't live in a traditional civilization, or you know, adding ideas of backwardsness. There are parts of the Barbarian class where if you're not wearing armor, then you are more powerful, which makes you think that all people within specific cultures never wore armor, which is factually inaccurate and also an odd thought. There's a lot there to unpack. There are whole medievalist papers that can surround, or that have surrounded and that can surround, the Barbarian class and the ideas that are inherent within it, and why those ideas are problematic because they enforce certain worldviews and are problematic to our, you know, modern ideas of how things are. But yeah, so there's a lot of issues. There's a lot of issues here. And we're going to talk about Star Trek now. So Klingons, in the original Star Trek trilogy, sort of started out as this oppositional force to the Federation, the sort of a post-scarcity utopian society that is somewhat based on Western society, that forms sort of, you know, the main guys that you follow within Star Trek. I don't know why I'm explaining this like people don't know Star Trek, but just in case you don't know anything about Star Trek, that's the sort of gist of it. Now, the Klingons were sort of a, you know, an analog for the Eastern powers, or, you know, the Common Turn, Warsaw Pact, whatever you want to call it, Soviet Union and its friends, but then have also sort of evolved into this idea of, you know, in more modern times, you know, the People's Republic of China. And they also, you know, take some ideas of warrior culture from different Earth cultures and sort of blend it together. I will say the Klingons have become much more of an idea of much more nuanced species than they were within the original Star Trek series, and even, you know, like, just a more modern take. More modern takes have been more adaptive and have gotten deeper into the idea of what a Klingon is. There are also other species, or big groups of species, who take from these ideas of human cultures. The Vulcans, Spock's race, or Spock's species, I should say, have very much so a Greek, an ancient Greek idea to them. And their genetic cousins, the Romulans, have a Imperial Roman sort of feel to them, you know, with the Romulan Star Empire and their architecture and the ideas that they have surrounding society. And then you have the Cardassians, who are the Cardassian Union, who are very much an analog of this idea of Nazi and nationalist fascist ideas surrounding an Earth or a whole interstellar civilization. You have ideas like the Ferengi, who are ultra-capitalist, and in some ways it can be seen as caricatures of racial minorities, or also as, you know, ideas surrounding corporate interests within modern Western society. And there are, in many ways, Star Trek has become more complex over the years. But when they first started, the ideas that, you know, everything was a monoculture, which is a term that I'm going to talk about just in a second here, was pretty prevalent. You know, the Klingons were all warriors who held honor, but, you know, were very clearly against the Federation for one idea or another. I think, honestly, it might have came, you know, don't quote me on this because, like I said, I'm not 100% sure, but their original dislike of each other came for some reason from just, you know, border disputes, which is strange when you think about it, but also, I mean, more valid than just like we're warriors and you're not, like monoculture, back to the term that I used, is the idea that everybody is similar, one culture is all the same. And if anybody has looked out the door recently, or, you know, seen people disagree online, knows that monocultures within a society are completely ridiculous. Whether we're looking at modern United States and seeing the differences between, say, you know, just a regular, you know, generic Republican and a generic, you know, Democrat, there are different cultural ideas there. There are different cultural ideas. One state to another, there can be different cultural ideas. One town to another, there can be different cultural ideas. Monocultures are incredibly inaccurate, and I don't want to judge another creator's ideas about things, especially when those ideas came 60 years ago and were done more for the efforts of doing a TV show than anything else. But I find monocultures to be very lazy. And this is a good little impromptu to get into the idea of what a planet of hats is. Because a planet of hats is the term for a monoculture, basically. To read for you from tvtropes.org in the Planet of Hats page, a planet of hats is a convenient way to make it so that the viewer's brain doesn't explode. But planet-wide monocultures seem a tad unlikely based off the best-known planet for Earthlings, ours. Just for comparison, within the 29% of Earth's surface that has solid land, our planet hosts just under 200 sovereign states with an estimated 5,000 ethnicities and 7,000 living languages. To assume that another world did not evolve in such a way to have just as much diversity as ours would be pretty ridiculous. As well, you know, basically the trope is so that it gives you an easy way for viewers to keep track of what planet is which and remember where the story is set. This happened a lot in early Star Trek and happened a lot later on too. And it happens especially when, you know, the Enterprise goes and visits a new planet and they beam down and it's like, oh, well, this is this first thing that we encountered must be the whole planet, which I think says a lot about ideas of like colonial ideas that we have as a society, as Western society, and that idea that we land somewhere and the first people we encounter are representative of everybody we're going to encounter in this land. You know, it tracks again with that idea, those ideas that like Columbus had, to bring in a crappy name again. His, you know, encountering a people and assuming that those people are everybody is very problematic. And, you know, Planet of Hats can be good and can be used in ways that are both decolonizing and also comedic. But used in really in ways that are like generalizing or stereotyping, or even, you know, taking a culture wholesale from Earth and then putting it on another planet and then just assuming the exact same things, can create a lot of problems when people watch that TV show and then adapt it into their own biases, or if that TV show reinforces biases they already had. If someone believes that we're going to do a different thing here. If someone believes that a group of people is greedy, or a group of people is going to steal all their land. And then they see that group of people with stereotypical things that they associate with those people doing those exact same things in Star Wars. Maybe like the Trade Federation, who, you know, can be very much seen as caricatures of Asian peoples. And if someone had a specific stereotypical view on those people and then sees that reinforced in their favorite media, do you think that their stereotypical views are going to be challenged? Or do you think that they're going to be reinforced and they're going to again think, or they're going to think even more that, you know, these people are such and such? It was very general using those terms, and I hope that came across properly. I was trying not to, like, as much as I could, reference actual stereotypes. It's hard to, though, when you're talking about this. You know, part of this conversation, you know, is me admitting, you know, that I'm a white person and I have the privilege of a white person. And having not experienced those stereotypes directly myself, I have to go off of the stereotypes that I see other white people perpetrating. And, you know, or not perpetrating, I should say. What's the word I'm looking for here? Spreading? Disseminating? I don't know. Anyways, the ones that they believe, right? And the ones that they, you know, talk about seeing, you know, repeated within media. So this idea, you know, like, Star Trek is really bad about it, but I just referenced, you know, Star Wars, which has its own, like, whole lot of Planet of Hats problems. You know, you go to this planet, and this planet is all of a jungle. And, of course, all the people that are living on that jungle haven't, like, you know, like some Earth cultures, created huge cities within the jungles. No, they're all, you know, tribes that live around and that don't have any technology and whatever, right? Reinforcing certain ideas about different areas of the world and reinforcing different ideas about how civilizations are created and how civilizations adapt and how peoples and cultures create themselves within different areas of the world. All things which, you know, are very old, very colonial, and very Western, biased views of how the world works. And it's problematic that those things continue to be used. You know, there are problems with specific aliens being used in gender discriminatory roles as well. For example, Star Wars, again, comes to mind. I know more about Star Wars, so I'm going to go into Star Wars 2 here. I know I didn't mention Star Wars at the beginning, but, you know, this is a conversation. This is a riff. I'm going off. Anyways, Twi'leks in the old expanded universe for Star Wars had something, I can't remember exactly what happened, but something happened to their homeworld, and they were basically all sold into slavery. And every time you see a female Twi'lek character, the odds are they're going to be, there's no other way to say this, but a sex slave, basically. And using a character like that as stereotypical, you know, is incredibly problematic in many ways. I keep saying the word problematic. There needs to be better words for it. It's wrong, right? Do you remember Return of the Jedi, right? You're in Jabba's palace, and there's a woman who's blue or green. I can't remember what color they painted her, but she has the big, like, tentacle things coming off of her head. Like the two big, sort of, they're like, look like horns, but floppier. That's a Twi'lek, right? And after Return of the Jedi, all the characters that you saw that were Twi'leks looked like that, or who were women looked like that, wearing chainmail bikinis or metal bikinis and, you know, attached to a chain from some mob boss or some evil man to sort of show, oh, this guy's a bad guy. But by using a woman as a tool to show that people are bad, you are also immediately characterizing and stereotyping the woman too. You're depicting them as all, you know, improper or all, you know, enslaved. It's problematic. I gotta stop using that word. I don't, it's hard to think of a word right off the bat. It's just really bad. It leaves no room for characters who break the mold. And as we know, in real life, basically everybody breaks molds. Everybody's a little bit different in some way. Everybody's a little bit different in lots of ways, generally speaking. And that sounded weird to say out loud because I generalize differences. But maybe that's a good way of thinking about it. Monocultures are a problem because nobody is different. I'm not saying you need everybody to be different. You can have surface-level similarities. That's culture, in many ways, is surface-level similarities between groups of people. Not a definition for culture. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, like, from a creator's perspective. Because we've moved into sort of the last part of this episode that I wanted to talk about. And that is, you know, putting on a bit of a creator hat and talking about the problems here, right? You can borrow ideas from a culture. That is fine. What you need to do, though, is create something new. You can borrow ideas from a culture or a couple of cultures and blend them all together and turn them into something different. But that culture can't be reinforcing of stereotypes that are within the culture that you created, that you took your ideas from. It can't be, you know, how everybody everywhere is going to see that culture. And you break this by having characters that are different, or characters that have some similarities but that are subtly different too. The Mandalorian, right? In it, we have this depiction of a Mandalorian who never takes off his helmet, because the subsect of Mandalorians that he belongs to never takes off his helmet. You learn later on that his depiction of what Mandalorians do are not every Mandalorian. And there are plenty who take off their helmet, who don't mind doing it, who aren't a member of his specific group. And they're all different people with different ideas of how things are going. You see a former Imperial intelligence agent who's played by Bill Burr. Right? In the first episode we see him in, he's ruthless and he's a terrible person. And you're like, oh, this guy's like every other Imperial. You know, he's just following, you know, he believes in everything that he's doing, and he's doing these things because he thinks this is the right thing to do because, you know, he's ruthless and everything like that. But then the second episode you see him, you realize that the reason he's not an Imperial anymore is because he got an order that he believed was wrong. He did something terrible. He killed a bunch of innocent people, and he hates it, and he hates the Empire because of it. Depth to a character gets rid of the idea that there is a planet of hats. Creating a character who has issues with their own culture and who is struggling to reconcile their own personal feelings with maybe something in their culture that they disagree with or they think shouldn't be the way it is, creates depth and breaks monoculture. Just because someone lives on a planet full of cowboys doesn't mean they don't want to be a milkman. You need a milkman at the end of the day, right? That's a weird analogy, but I'm using the analogy. And, you know, this comes back to caricatures and this idea that not everybody is the same. You can't paint everybody as the same, because painting everybody as the same gives people justifications for behaviors they don't like. It gives people justifications to try to condemn an entire group of people because one person in that group was mean to them at one occasion in their life. Or because someone has told them that that entire group of people are trying to kill them. even though that person understands very little about that group of people. Or maybe a small group of a larger religious group commits an act of terrorism against a country, and then that country spends the next 20 years trying to depict that group as evil or less to justify imperialist campaigns against them. That was 9/11 that I was talking about. And that was the United States' response to 9/11. The idea that we need to confront the racism, not only in real life, but in our entertainment and our media, I think is important. You need to, at the end of the day, realize that not everybody from one group is the same. And this extends into queer folks as well. I talked about in the very first episode tropes. And tropes are caricatures at the end of the day. They're the exact same thing in many ways. Specifically when they're referring to tropes that are character archetypes. Something that I've had to deal with tons of times in my life as a bisexual person is that people think that I am sexually promiscuous right off the bat when they hear that I'm bisexual. Whether or not that is the case is completely irrelevant in the face of someone assuming that about me. Because if they assume that about me, they assume that about every single other person who is also bisexual. Assuming that someone does A and so B, it can lead to a lot of problematic situations. I gotta stop saying problematic. Can lead to a lot of situations where people assume things about other people. Assumptions lead to broad definitions. They lead to things like racism and homophobia. The idea that people who are queer are sexually promiscuous is a product of the 80s. It's a product of, you know, religious persecution on the part of Christian religious conservatives. It's related to the AIDS crisis and people assuming that certain people who, you know, gay men specifically, were sexually promiscuous and that's why they got AIDS. Even though, you know, and this is a thing from, you can look it up too, it's from the United States' Center for Disease Control. It is more likely for someone to get AIDS through a blood transfusion than it is to get AIDS from performing anal sex. So, as you can see, anyone could get AIDS. And putting stereotypes around that can lead to a lot of problems. And those stereotypes start at sexual promiscuity in our media being portrayed as a trait that is something that queer people are. Am I saying that a queer person cannot be sexually promiscuous? God, no. Of course not. But when the only queer character in your piece of media is sexually promiscuous, you create a character that people are going to assume means everyone. When your only black character is a member of a gang, when your only female Asian character is wearing sexually revealing clothing, when your only indigenous character has a drinking problem. These are all things that you can find in our media today. You can find in our nerdy media today. And even if those people are wearing face ridges or have pointy ears, people still see the people they're going to see. they still see those same racist or homophobic idea or sexist ideas of what these people should be and what these people represent within our real world. So we need to tackle these things. We need to talk about the problems with these things. And we need to confront discrimination within our media. Because at the end of the day, discrimination in our media is just a reflection of discrimination in our everyday life. And if you confront one but don't confront the other, you're not confronting it at all. It's a bit early, but I honestly think that's a pretty good place to stop for this episode. So this episode's going to be a little bit shorter than a normal one. I apologize if anybody was looking forward to hearing another 10 minutes of my voice. But I think that's a good place to end. It's a really good place to sort of stop my message and maybe open the door for people to talk about it. And again, like I said, I am a white man, a white cisgendered man. This is all taken with, you know, a certain amount of, should be taken with a certain amount of bias with regards to my own privilege. If you would like to talk about something specific to your experience, whether that is with regards to your gender, with regards to your sexual preferences, with regards to your ethnicity, definitely reach out, because I'd love to have this conversation with more people. I would love to talk and let someone else talk about their personal experiences and how that changed and how that is different from how I see things, because it's going to be at the end of the day. And if you would like to reach out, you can reach out through Gmail by emailing me at radionerdwlu@gmail.com, or you can respond to the post for this episode or shoot me a DM on Instagram at radio_nerdwlu. Yes, that's correct. I don't know why I have a problem with coming up with the Instagram name every time. I think I just haven't used it as much. Anyways, please feel free to reach out. And I hope you guys have a great week. Look forward to the Gamergate episode coming out next week. All right. Bye.